9 o'clock hour, Sports Radio 610. Good morning, everybody. Appreciate you joining us on a Wednesday. Alongside Seth Payne, I'm Sean Bajani, in for Sean Pendergast, who is vacationing in Jamaica.
Maybe who's he arguing with on Twitter right now on his vacation?
Well, various people, I think. Yordan Alvarez is the center point of the conversation, and I don't know exactly the impetus of it, but I'll pull up the most recent quote tweet from Sean within the last hour to somebody named Daniel Meyer, who said, Yordan's open market value is over $40 million per season. Even knowing he's only going to play 130 games most seasons, he is one of the five best hitters on the planet. And then Pendergast followed up with, what about seasons where he plays 30 games? This hand thing is now a reoccurring injury. I'm surprised how cavalier a lot of my followers are about this. And then the response was, I like you, man, but you and a few others are wrong on this one. He's one of the best deals in MLB right now. And Pendergast says, I like you too, Phil, to another responder. Which brings up a question for me. We're going through this now without Yordan Alvarez, okay? Just keep it to Yordan for a second, Seth. Never mind the Astros have won 51 games with significant underperformance by Christian Walker. Never mind they've done it with like six starting pitchers on the injured list. Never mind all of that stuff. You are winning a lot of baseball games in convincing fashion that you're beating teams outside of just the crappy ones that exist in your division, okay? There's no argument about that. And you're doing it without a player that has hit at least 31 home runs four straight seasons for you in Yordan Alvarez. Is this going to end up making it that much easier when it comes time for extension talk between Yordan Alvarez and the Houston Astros? The way that you felt about Alex Bregman and Kyle Tucker and how much that smarted a lot of people, are you now less susceptible to that sting?
Is it going to be easier to deal with him not being extended?
Yeah.
Or, okay.
I think there's contributing factors here that say
You know, I didn't know if you're asking, does it make it easier to sign him or not sign him or whatever it might be. So you're asking, is it easier to deal with the fact that he'll probably be gone when his contract expires?
Yeah.
If he remained as injured as this, then yes, it will be. It's already easy for me. I don't, like, honestly, like, the Astros have broken me when it comes to hoping that you're going to retain some guy. I have no emotional reaction to Jeremy Pena probably leaving after next year, because this is what I've come to expect. So I don't know if it makes it easier or harder. I do think it makes it more interesting, because Yordan already signed his extension the first time, I think, with an understanding that he had had some injury issues already, and, you know, perhaps wanted to have the insurance of all the guaranteed money, even if it was less than what his market value would end up being. So I think when he comes up for extension, depending on however much, like, what his recent injury history has been, I think there's a good chance he gets comes to another deal with the Astros, kind of like what Lance McCullers did with the Astros, where you acknowledge that the injuries have been an issue, but I like being here. So I guess, if anything, I'll be a little bit more, maybe could anticipate him pulling an Altuve and just doing another team-friendly extension.
Just to caution people, I don't know if you were being like facetious or, you know, maybe you misspoke. I don't know. Jeremy Payne is not going anywhere. He's got two arbitration years left with the Astros. So there are a couple more years of team control for Jeremy Payne.
But he's got Scott Boras as his agent. I'm saying, like,
after the 28 season, you know, so you got him until he's about 30 years old. So let's not get there. I already know that's going to happen, Seth. I already know. I don't want to think about it right now, okay? I want to enjoy a couple more years of Jeremy Pena. Get him another ALCS and a World Series MVP before he puts on a different uniform for my liking. But I think
it'd be after the 27 season when he's
after the 27 season. I think it's definitely easier, because at one point, do you have to become comfortable with the Astros' decision-making process? Like, the business side of baseball, like, where we've got this, you know, there's the rule of four, where the Astros, you score four more runs and they're excellent. there's a rule of five contractually with the Astros where they ain't going to give you any other year beyond five. Alex Bregman in that offer was an exception. Do they make a similar exception to Yordan Alvarez? I don't know. Let's wait and see and get there. But after losing, you know, Gerrit Cole and Carlos Correa and George Springer, you've been down this road before. Charlie Morton left you to go make $30 million with the Atlanta Braves. And you've gone through this time and time and time again. Now, Bregman and Tucker, two guys you thought were going to be lifers at one point in time, right? Well, Yordan, he's going to be next man up at some point in time. It should be very comfortable for you outside of just the injury situation, especially because at the end of the day, this ball club has found a way to win and continue on this run that they've been on.
Yordan's got 3 years left on his deal after this year. So it'd be in 2029, he'll be 32 years old. That's where it's the sweet spot for Yordan, maybe, especially if he continues to have injury issues where he has to miss 30 or 40 games a year.
Yeah.
I would say like that's ripe for a Jose Altuve type extension where it takes him through like age 35, but it's reduced for Yordan. It would take him through age 35 or so, been reduced on the back end. I'm less nervous about his long-term tenure with the Astros than like any other young guy that's still in his extreme youth.
Yeah, you know, consider this as well. Somebody just texted in, trade Alvarez. We're also very used to this. It's trading for impact players, not necessarily trading away impact players. I know you traded Kyle Tucker, okay? But that situation was kind of FUBAR because you knew the amount of money it was going to take to retain Kyle Tucker and certainly the years, and that number has only grown. But I don't know. Don't kick out of bed the idea that maybe the Astros do consider at some point in time moving Yordan Alvarez if a deal sounds right, looks right. I don't know. I don't want it to get to that point. I'm just saying because it's not happened, you know, in the last decade or so very much, yeah, doesn't mean it can't happen. Is that Murphy's Law or something like that?
Murphy's Law is if something bad can happen, then it will happen, I think.
Yeah, well, which is the Astros injury situation. Yeah,
just because something hasn't happened, it doesn't mean it couldn't happen. That's more of a black swan scenario.
Yeah.
That's how people get themselves into housing crises. Like, oh, no, real estate never goes down. We're good. So we'll just bank on that never happening ever. Ah, crap. Yeah.
A random question for you, maybe. Maybe not so random. And we were talking Texans earlier, but I'm just thinking, like, you know, with all this offseason talk and we're comparing the Texans to the Rockets and how excited we have been over the course of the last couple of years, from a Texans perspective, what's the one offseason move this offseason? What's the one offseason move you think they could end up regretting the most, either any point in the season or at season's end?
I think the one that... You know, my gut is to tell me to say the entire way they handled the offensive line, since they weren't as aggressive in going after free agents the way that teams like the Bears or the Vikings were in trying to bolster their offensive line, that the offensive line situation I'm still uncomfortable with. I can see where they can definitely be better than last year, but I would have liked them to be more aggressive. So as part and parcel to that, I'm going to say that I think Laken Tomlinson being signed and just seemingly penciled in there as the starter at left guard, it makes me nervous just because it feels a lot like Shaq Mason did, where you're taking a player who's in his early 30s and he's not quite the player he used to be, that sometimes that fall, either because of injuries or just poor reduced performance, ends up being more of a headache than you're hoping. Like, you're bringing in a guy that's a great leader, this, that, the other thing. But just at the end of the day, I need to see performance out of him. So that would be also, you know, wrapped up in, man, if the offensive line doesn't substantially improve, that goes square back on what was your offseason strategy when you got rid of three starters and then were not that aggressive in trying to replace them, or you just failed to replace them. I think that's probably what most people fear about how this offseason might not work out.
I think from the basis of my question, like, what's the one thing they could regret this offseason at some point in time? I think it can't be anything other than offensive line centric, right? But I thought you were actually going to say the impetus of the offensive line overhaul in trading Laremy Tunsil. You know, moving on from the best guy on that line, you know, one of the best left tackles in the game. Like, is there anything that could occur, you know, that would make you say in the middle of a season or at season's end, like, boy, you really, there's some things that you have to just live with sometimes. And maybe yeah. Laremy Tunsil should have just been one of those with the contract and, you know, maybe the vet being a vet kind of a thing.
I think that the problem is with Laremy Tunsil is that for the amount of money you were paying him, he just didn't provide enough in some of the things that really matter,
yeah.
but are harder to keep track of.
I agree.
Like run blocking, for instance. There's no reason he should have been as bad at run blocking or as disengaged at times in run blocking as he was. The false starts, I know a lot of people like to act like that's no big deal. The false starts were a problem not just because of the 5 yards, not just because they you know, knocked you from 3rd and 7 into 3rd and 12 and all of those types of scenarios. It was the selfishness that fueled the false starts. But this, you're taking one of the best athletes in the amongst offensive linemen in the league, and he's just trying to get as much of a head start as possible in that down and doing it at the expense of everybody else. And when it's supposed to be a guy who's a team leader.
Yeah.
Like that, all of that combined, then his lackadaisical attitude towards practice. Now, there's no part of me that's going to say, I don't care how well he does in Washington. If they wanted to fix that whole O-line, you had a bunch of inferior football players trying to emulate a guy who got away with doing it the lazy way. And that just, yeah, I was done with him. I couldn't handle watching another false start.
Text message says, Texans signed these veteran offensive linemen, I think is much to establish practice and culture until the youngsters eventually take over this season. I mean, that's a thought, I think, maybe not necessarily across the board, but at, you know, certain positions, you know, enter Arianti Ursary. You know, what kind of a role do we think he plays, you know, at left tackle? Is he the guy, you know, from day one? Is that something that he's going to have to earn? You know,
yeah. And I mean, if you look at last year, people were frustrated that the Texans you guys didn't address safety in the offseason. And you're like, they drafted Kalen Bullock. No, you didn't draft that. Simmons is sitting out there. And then lo and behold, your draft pick performs. And you say, oh, looks like they had a plan at safety all along.
Yeah,
I think
with
Arianti Ursary, there's some of that where, you know, you look at a guy, they traded up in the second round to get him. And there's a tendency, just because when a guy is in a first round pick, you shouldn't rely on any rookie, but you sometimes it's impossible to feel like the guy in a position of real need. I think people tend to feel like, well, you know, Ursary's not going to fix it. So what was your plan? All right, Ursary was part of the plan. Bringing in some of the other veteran players were other parts of the plan. And then Blake Fisher is really probably the biggest X factor, because if he can build on what he did last year, where he did some really good things, but he also did some really rookie type things,
yeah,
then all of a sudden you could potentially be set at offensive tackle with Ursary and Blake Fisher for several years to come. But there's X factors all over the place on the O-line.
Yeah, yeah. Well, all right. So with Ursary, now you get me thinking, like, the position that, you know, people are very cautious and nervous about, and not confident, period, in the Texans evaluating and drafting, especially high in drafts, is offensive linemen, right?
you
think about Kenyon Green and how bad, you know, that's gone, or went, rather. Could Arianti Ursary be maybe one of, if not the best decisions the Texans made this offseason, either via draft or free agency, just because of the position and the being a part of the one group that has just been their weakest link for a lot of years?
I mean, yeah, if he works out as a player, then it was. But that's the whole problem that we're talking about is, all right, can you actually draft and get in some of these good offensive linemen? Yes, it could be. If Arianti Ursary works out, that'll be huge. Not like Nick Caserio is trying to keep score of how the fans feel about him. But I think amongst the fan base, if Arianti Ursary is a hit, then yeah, that has an outsized importance because you might feel like, oh, okay, I trust that these guys know what they're doing with evaluating offensive linemen. I trust that they can actually, you know, build on this next year and get a genuinely studly offensive line.
Yeah, yeah, I think that's the idea. You're right. We got a YouTuber that says the false starts cost games. Brought back opening touchdown drives. That switched momentum. Also cost me money on the parlays.
Yeah. Well, yeah. No, there were so many times where it was in the fourth quarter of that Cowboys game a few years ago now, where just Laremy Tunsil had multiple false starts and in the fourth quarter. And yeah, they're drive killers, and especially in the fourth quarter, they can be game losers. You knock yourself out of field goal position with a false start, that counts more than just a run-of-the-mill first down in the first quarter type of false start.
Yeah. You know, maybe the best offseason move that the Texans will have made, like you look back on it at the end of the season and say it could be not a signing, but a trade. Kenyon Green for CJ Gardner-Johnson. When they made that deal, Seth, you're thinking like, okay, one, how did you pull this off? You know, Kenyon Green, and you get CJ Gardner-Johnson, like a guy with that talent level. And then you start looking a little bit deeper, and it's like, okay, yeah, you know, he had the 6 picks last year. He's led the NFL in interceptions before. Cool. You already felt pretty solid about the secondary and defense in general. Now you add C.J. Gardner-Johnson to the mix. Like, holy smokes, the depth, the versatility that D'Amico's got now with, you know, maybe a really great secondary and a really great edge rush. You combine those two, this defense is going to be really difficult to score on. I don't know how you say otherwise off the top of my head. C.J. Gardner-Johnson, to me, could very well be that guy in that move that you say, yeah, that right there might have been what sealed the deal defensively.
Well, that's a cool one just to remember. If it works out and it's a great trade, that's a Daryl Morey type of trade where it happens because the GM is always on the phone. So, It was a salary dump for the Eagles more so than anything, and you managed to trade Kenyon Green for what looks on paper like, oh, a pick swap, and then Kenyon Green for C.J. Gardner-Johnson. So the Eagles would have done that with a lot of other teams. It's just that they happened to have the right conversations going at the right moments with the Texans, and that's where the moves like that work out, that's the benefit of having a guy like Caserio compared to, say, like, you know, Brian Gaine. Brian Gaine was lacking in that regard in terms of trade activity.
Yeah.
I'm not saying you have to be as active as Nick Caserio, but Caserio is just, he's been in the league forever. He's got good relationships and people trust him. So you end up getting opportunities like that.
He's Seth Payne, Sean Bajani in for Sean Pendergast. If you'd like to continue to weigh in, you know the number, 713-572-4610. Coming up next, you mentioned Nick Caserio. The assistant Texans general manager, Chris Blanco, we'll let you hear from him on how and why the Texans have become maybe a little bit more nerdy than they had been in the past. That's next. In for Sean Pendergast, I'm Sean Bajani along with Seth Payne. Coming up in a half hour, it'll be time for the fellas on In the Loop. Reggie Atatula, Chris Partee in for John Lopez once again. Reggie just popped in. Seth, want to make sure if our listeners have not heard about it yet, tomorrow, going to be a very different day on Sports Radio 610. It's a radiothon that we're going to be putting on. It's going to be Reggie Atatula and Ron Hughley. It's Reggie and Ron's radiothon. They'll be live all day from 6 a.m. until 6 p.m. And you're going to be on in the morning with them. I'm going to be on to close things out towards the evening between 4 and 6. And all of the different hosts throughout the day are going to be popping in and doing that. And it's all to benefit the Houston Food Bank. If you could check Ron Hughley's Twitter, Reggie Atatula's Twitter, I've got it on my timeline. There's a link there that you can click on and donate to the Houston Food Bank for that great cause. And that's what we'll be supporting tomorrow for Reggie and Ron's radiothon. So we'll talk to those guys here in just about a half hour. But between now and then, Seth, you know, we played a cut that was pertinent, I think, to something we were discussing in terms of clubhouse culture and things like that, discussing the Astros. Chris Blanco, who's the Texans assistant general manager, was on Ari Mirov's podcast. He does an NFL spotlight every so often. And Ari Mirov covers the NFL, has for a long time, writes and does some work for the 33rd team, which is an excellent website. You'd handpicked a number of pertinent cuts from Chris Blanco as part of this interview that you wanted to share with everybody.
Yeah, well, it was fun because Blanco, when he sits down and starts talking, you realize, oh, okay, this isn't your normal football guy. Like this guy could have, you know, he could be a CEO at a tech company or something. The first 5 minutes of the conversation, I was like, man, this guy, this is exactly the kind of nerd that I want in my front office in the NFL these days, or in any sports organization. This guy he did play football in college, but he got a law degree, and he kind of set his sights on working in the front office, and he lays out this path that he followed to get to where he is now. But the type of guy, this is, ask yourself if you're driving, if you were this type of kid growing up. This is him on what his childhood was like.
You know, I'll go all the way back. My mom, she's a chemical engineer. She works on Excel. She loves it. She put my brother and I on Excel when we were probably 9 years old doing our baseball stats. And you talk about aha moments. I had an aha moment watching like summer baseball on TNT or TBS. And I saw slugging percentage and ERA, and I didn't know what the equation was. And I'm 9 years old, so I really don't know much about, you know, algebra at that point. But I just remember sitting at the computer for like days, and I finally figured out how to calculate slugging percentage. I finally figured out how to calculate ERA.
At nine? You're 9 years old messing around on Excel. What the... What the hell have I been doing with my entire life?
All I can think about, though, he said his mom was a chemical engineer. So yeah. Coming from, generally speaking, pretty intelligent family, I would say. I remember being a kid, the first thing I would do in the morning is I'd go get the sports section, you know, from the coffee table, and I'd lay down on the carpet and just pour over the stats. And something makes me think that, you know, at the age of 6, 7, 8, 9, you know, during my youth years, if I had a computer in the house and I knew what the hell Excel was back in the 90s, then yeah, I would have probably done the same thing.
You probably would have. Yeah, you start looking at it and you're trying to organize all this stuff in your head, and then you stumble into this, or your mom gives you this tool that you can actually sort these things out. As a 9-year-old, though, to figure out the formulas and everything,
that's pretty funny.
I found that impressive. But then you start to worry, like, wait a second, we don't want to be too nerdy. And that's why I like the answer that he gave when asked about how do they go about building this roster around CJ Stroud?
Yeah, I think the best thing about Nick and D'Amico when they build a roster, it's never solely focused on one player, be it the quarterback, a pass rusher, wide receiver, et cetera. It's really about bringing in highly competitive football players who are physically, mentally tough, you know, who have a level of aggression in the way that they play, and who are good people in the locker room.
The level of aggression that they play with, that's the one that I feel like, I don't know if they have stats for it or if they, you know, how they account for it on their spreadsheets or anything, but they've done a really good job of identifying those on the defensive side of the ball. Like those guys play with a level of aggression. Now, when it comes to building a team around CJ, like first and foremost, it's always great to have a great defense on the other side of you, so they've taken care of that. I think that level of aggression is something that was missing on the offensive line.
Yeah.
It was missing in the tight ends group when they're blocking. Some of that boils down to just playing with poor technique. It's hard to be aggressive.
You know.
But the just is one of your, as an analytically minded person, to still have level of aggression as one of the most important things you're looking at.
Yeah.
That's hard to quantify. I like that. I like that he respects that part of the game.
You mentioned, like, you don't know if there's a stat for that, right? I would imagine there's going to be at some point if it doesn't exist, but I was thinking about, you've seen like the havoc stat
they
use for edge rushers and stuff like that. I wonder, I don't know the equation for that, but I wonder if there is a degree to whatever they do use for that you could apply to other positions, because when you're talking about the level of aggression, isn't it somewhat equivalent to how you're affecting a play? Because if you're being aggressive, then you're affecting a play in a positive way on your side of the ball anyway, right?
Yeah, well, right. But then some guys make plays and they're not all that aggressive, you know? So I think that's where, if you're trying to quantify it, That's one of those classic things that you just know it when you see it. You can see, you can watch a guy and see if they're playing aggressively or not compared to guys that sometimes might rack up plays, but they're not all that aggressive. I think on the analytical side of it, a lot of the GPS data probably reflects that.
Oh, yeah,
you know,
good
like,
point.
Like how fast are those guys running on plays where they're away from the ball? You know, like how much ground do they cover to make a play? Yeah. So I'm guessing that's a combination of the eyeball test, but then a lot of the GPS data that the teams have that we as the public don't have yet.
Yeah. Somebody text in, do we know how to calculate slugging percentage now? Need a reference, baseball reference. I don't know. Off the top of my head, no. I'm not that nerdy.
I wish I'm going to learn how to calculate WAR on my own. It's a relatively simple formula. I just don't want to learn it, damn it.
Yeah, well, you're dealing with a whole bunch of different numbers there in that situation. Anything else pop to you from Chris Blanco?
This is Blanco on how they go about retaining their current players.
That's the strategy there is like, hey, just trying to get the best football players in our building on the football field. And, you know, from short term, long term, it's like, you know, putting ourselves in a position where we're able to retain our talent. You know, we don't want to develop players and then, you know, watch them walk out the door. You know, we want to be in a position where we're able to retain for long term success.
And that's very much in line. That's not breaking news or anything with what they've been doing with these guys and their extensions with the third-year players. Where, you know, it used to be pretty common that if you were going to get an extension after your third year, it was because you're a future Hall of Famer like J.J. Watt or something. I think the Texans have been more aggressive than certainly teams of the past or a lot of other teams. And I like it. The part that makes me nervous is putting that vote of confidence in a player who's still young, and can you really expect that you're going to get that over the next 5 years out of them? I'm less nervous about it with the Texans just because I think, like everything we've talked about already, I think they've identified the guys that they know are going to keep putting out and keep working at it, whether they win a Super Bowl or whether they're all pro or whether they get a huge contract. That part I feel good about because the downside to not extending your own young players is that the replacement cost can be huge.
Yeah.
You can end up drafting three more guys before you find a guy as good as that.
You know,
and how much money do you spend on those draft picks or those free agency acquisitions? So like that part of having sustained success, I think they're just on a much better track now than they were in previous years.
The job of, you know, talent evaluators, particularly in football, we talk about this all the time. Like, you know, is this player going to fit this particular scheme? You know, in making these business decisions, you know, like Chris Blanco is an assistant GM working with Nick Caserio, you know, as GM, they have to make all the time and determine like, hey, this is a really good player and we'd like him here for the long term. But during that same time, the life of that player's contract that you just extended for the next 3 to 5 years, you determine that, you know what, it's time for a change at coordinator. It's time for a change at head coach. We see this all the time. And that player that you really liked, that you wanted to commit all this money and years to, maybe there's a chance they're not going to be that guy, that player, that of that productivity with a new head coach or a new coordinator.
Yeah.
It's so agonizing to think, like, I'm listening to Chris Blanco and I'm just thinking like, yeah, that's a really hard job. That's just a really, really hard job.
To figure out exactly, all right, was the scheme the problem? Was Bobby Slowick the issue? Was it these specific offensive linemen? They kind of hit the easy button with the offensive line because they just said, all right, we're going to get rid of all the starters and the offensive line coach and the offensive coordinator, and we're just going to start from scratch. Here we go. Expansion year. Let's do it.
It's the easy button, yet I don't know that fans like the answer that they got.
It's the simple button. They hit the simple button.
It's a simple button. But you got a whole bunch of guys that were like, they were kind of sketch, you know, in their previous stops. And now all of a sudden, like, the Texans are going to be the Houston Astros in this miraculous way that they've been able to rehabilitate and, figure out why these pitchers have not had success elsewhere. But they're going to be great here. You know, we're just going to reinvigorate them as Astros. Now the Texans are going to do the same thing with linemen.
Okay, because the kids are on break, and there might be some young aspiring sports industry kids out there. This is Chris Blanco on his advice for getting a job in the NFL.
Yeah, I would tell them to be extremely persistent and have an open mind in terms of what that entry-level position looks like, but also have a pretty dialed-in vision of like who you see yourself to become in, you know, 2 years, 5 years down the line. For me, the way I kind of like rationalize or like look, logically look at things is, if I work in the NFL, like, okay, general managers, what are their backgrounds? The majority come through personnel scouting. There's a handful who come through football admin. There's a handful that have coaching backgrounds. So for me, it's like using that type of reasoning. It's like, okay, so what does that mean? Okay, this is like legal business side. This is the scouting side. So for me, going into my process, like I had a pretty good understanding of what an organization was looking for in me as an applicant. So I would tell that to the same thing as someone trying to break into the business, is like have a very just kind of dialed in plan, as well as a networking piece.
That the way it reminds me of Roger Goodell, who like at the age of 15 decided he wanted to be commissioner of the NFL, and like that's a very rare and specific job goal for a 15-year-old to have.
Yeah,
but he went out and kind of realized, oh, there's a path to that. Like, this is what I have to do. And you kind of demystify it. I love hearing from, so like Chris Blanco is not a completely atypical potential GM because he played college football and everything. It wasn't like some of the stories you hear about guys that just never played football before but break in. He followed a conventional path in some ways, but also knew that, okay, to get into the front office, I got to show this side of me that is the analytical side. And like the law degree sets him apart a little bit in some respects. That it's not as mysterious as it sometimes feels like it might be.
Yeah.
Like there is a path, and you just find out what other people have done and the path they followed, and then just emulate it.
Yeah.
You just follow the leader in that regard.
Yeah. Seth Payne, Sean Bajani, in for Sean Pendergast. I got a question for you on the other side in regards to the Texans' path. When you're talking about all this data and analytics, I want to know how long they've been down that path, how deep they are right now. We'll discuss that coming up next. And we'll also talk to the guys in the loop, Reggie Atatula, Chris Partee, in for John Lopez once again today. We'll talk to the fellas next at Sports Radio 610. And for Sean Pendergast, Sean Bajani, along with Seth Payne, final segment this morning for us. And then we'll welcome in Reggie Atatula and Chris Partee, who's in for John Lopez on In the Loop today with Figgy Fig. I would imagine going to be here as well. They'll have the question of the day. That was always fun this week. I enjoyed that, the conversation through crosstalk. Thinking about the question of the day, Reggie was working on one the last couple of minutes. I'm sure he's arrived.
Oh, we're getting it cold. It's hard, man. It's hard when they don't give us the all right.
Well, I told him yesterday, you know, he sprung it on me like two straight days, but it was my fault yesterday because he'd text me like around this time.
Yeah.
And I didn't know it.
All right. Just get ready, man. Just get mentally sharp for this.
Yeah. Well, they've been really easy questions. What was it yesterday? Longest wait ever, most memorable wait. That was fun. Though it wasn't fun whenever. About the story that I had in 2007. That wasn't good. We were talking about and listening to some really interesting audio from Chris Blanco, Texans assistant general manager, and talking a lot of analytics and, you know, without getting too nerdy and stuff, like it is very much a part of sports, and we probably speak more about it in baseball than anything else these days. And I'm curious from you if you know just how deep in the weeds are the Houston Texans into like advanced data.
They're a lot. Yeah, a lot. Like, and I'd say they're ahead of the curve with a lot of teams. If you look at the average NFL team, has somewhere between, I want to say, it depends, you know, how they accumulate these stats or compile these stats, but 10 or 15 people in their analytics department. I mean, the Texans as an organization, they have at least 21 people in their front office who have like either science, research, or data attached to their job title. So they've got their football performance research department. That's three different people. Then you've got football technology and decision science. I think that's 12 or 13 people. Their sports performance, which is separate from strength and conditioning, has four people in it. So director of applied sports science, applied sports science coordinator. Nick is into it. It's just that football teams are really careful about never publicizing or acting like they're into it. Other than, I think Minnesota has probably leaned into it the hardest. But yeah, I'm not worried about the Texans falling behind in that regard at all. And I think the thing that I like about it is that Caserio, very much as a guy who's been a coach, and has seen all sides of the business, I think him, kind of like it was with you know, the combination of AJ Hinch and Jeff Luno, they know how to balance out the science from what actually works on the field and what can we actually utilize.
Is that something that he was doing, you know, to a pretty serious degree in New England? Like, did he bring that from what he'd learned up there here? Or is that something that, like, you know, dependent upon who he's working with as a head coach, like the demands or requests by D'Amico Ryans or whoever, like, you know, we should really take a bigger look at this and expand our department because it's very helpful. And D'Amico's in that tweener stage where he was in the league probably when they started using a little bit more of that, but also got a taste of where they didn't really pay too much attention to the advanced data.
Well, then, you know, the guy never gets any credit in D'Amico's upbringing as a player and as a coach is Chip Kelly. And Kelly was gung-ho into a lot of the sports science stuff. Chip Kelly was doing a lot of stuff that they'd been doing in Europe with soccer players already. And he brought that to college football and then on into the NFL. So D'Amico has talked about how much he appreciated learning that side of it and that view of it. And yeah, I think D'Amico is a lot like Luno in that regard, is that he was a player, understands everything that goes with that, the things that sometimes you can't quantify or figure out, but then also with an appreciation that, all right, the analytics gives us a lot of tools and perhaps gives us a lot, it can help expose a lot of blind sites, spots that I wouldn't have seen before. So that part of it feels good. I think D'Amico's got a pretty good blend of it.
Yeah. It's interesting to me. I love that because it is 2025, and I feel like in baseball, somebody that's followed like that sport for a very long time, data, you know, stats have been very much a part of that game for a long, long time. And the NFL, that's, you know, got a lot of different moving parts, and I almost feel like maybe football, at least from a, you said like they don't publicize it a lot, right? At least NFL teams don't. It feels like they're a little bit behind in terms of what they use or maybe can use or comfortable in using versus what they do in baseball.
Yeah, I think there are a lot of teams that do a lot. And it's a lot of times you'll see, I'll see people like, you know, write an article about breaking down a team analytically or something. And the replies are always, why aren't NFL teams using guys like you? And I'm like, they are. They're like, this guy wants to get one of those jobs. They're using, they are using all of it. But the head coach at any given time and in play calling can also just, you know, shut off his earpiece. And he doesn't necessarily have to hear that he should be going for it.
Yeah.
Or not going for it.
Well, that's the data, you know, like in the 2 minutes or less, right? Like,
yeah,
we see the stats all the time. Like, here's a play, you know, facing this down, this yardage, what you should do, and then you see your play caller for your insert favorite team not do that at all.
Right. Those drive charts are so annoying though too, because they don't account for everything that's happened in the game necessarily and the physical state of your players. Like there's still that part of being a coach that, man, sometimes you can look in a guy's eye and see that he's frazzled or that he's shot or that your quarterback's hand is shaking or whatever it might be. That's where, like, now it's almost gotten to the point where people at first didn't want their coaches to be listening to computers, or now they get irate if the computer says that, no, it was a 52% better outcome probability if you had done this instead of the 48% if you had done that. You idiot. How could you ever?
Yeah, well, to go baseball again, how many times have you heard from Joe Espada or Dusty Baker, you know, in recent years? Well, we like the matchup. When all of the stats and analytics say that you should not be using this pitcher against this hitter or vice versa or throwing him these pitches.
Yeah,
but we like the matchup.
But sometimes the amateur nerds get a little ahead of themselves. They're still, they'll be using data about this righty pitcher versus this lefty lineup or whatever it might be, where the teams themselves are actually using way more advanced stuff than just lefty or righty and everything. Like they're able to break the, like, I don't know. I think there's just, there's way more people want to cling on to the perception that there's the nerds and there's the jocks and never the two shall meet. The majority of teams they've merged the nerds and the jocks by this point.
Yeah, they're figuring that out a little bit better these days. Tonight it's Hunter Brown on the mound for the Astros. Game two of a 3-game set. Astros 51-34, continuing to kill it. Now a season high 17 games above .500. Seth, a 7-game lead over the Mariners. This feels like with as many questions now surrounding Jeremy Peña's, you know, kind of near future, Yordan Alvarez's status the rest of this season with the setback of his hand, feels like a really opportune time to capitalize on this team that you're playing in Colorado. Get this dub tonight, and hell, for that matter, you get this sweep, you might be looking at an 8-plus game lead by series end over the Mariners, and that provides you a really darn good cushion going up against a couple of more competitive ball clubs in the Cleveland Guardians and the L.A. Dodgers, which remain on your schedule, along with the Rangers, but you're not really worried about them before you get to the All-Star break.
No, this is going to be an awesome Independence Day weekend, because if you've got an afternoon game tomorrow, and a lot of you will be off of work already, and then you roll right into three games against the Dodgers. Yeah, what are you going to learn from these next two games versus the Rockies? There is that part of me that still fears playing down to an opponent. Now that the Astros are definitively above opponents like the Rockies, don't play down to the Rockies just as you've got this Dodgers series coming up. Continue this stretch of series in which you haven't lost 11 straight in a row. You've either tied or won.
Yeah, yeah.
I don't want to let up versus the Rockies at all. I want to just crush and destroy this franchise, who was given too much of a glimmer of hope last night.
Yeah, well,
they need to be held in their place, damn it.
Josh Hader tried to make it a little interesting last night. it was going to be close anyway, because, you know, aside from the Victor Caratini, grand slam, the Astros had just put two runs on the board in a place that a lot of other baseball teams have hit really well.
No, and I'll tell you the other big thing, honestly, regardless of whether they win or lose, I don't want to go into the Dodgers games with the bullpen beleaguered or tired at all. So the ability of Hunter to go deep into a game and just to eat up some innings so that you can be as close to full strength as this ridiculously battered baseball team can be. Yeah. That's where I'm emotionally invested in the starting pitching over the next couple nights.
Yeah, well, Hunter Brown tonight, and you got Brandon Walter tomorrow, today game. But Hunter Brown, as good as he is, you got to admit, a little nervous about him pitching in Colorado tonight, even though the Rockies suck.
They're that bad. I don't think people appreciate how bad the Rockies are.
I know, but
they've got the third worst offense in baseball playing in that ballpark. No, I'm not nervous.
I get
it. I'm irrationally cocky about this.
I get it, but somebody had five hits off of Astros pitching last night. Jordan Beck.
Yeah.
Some ways I don't care what, you know, the exit velocity was. It's just I'm just a little nervous about Hunter Brown pitching in Colorado. It's like, why? I don't want his nice, impressive, clean stat sheet to be reckoned with in Colorado.
I want to see him pitch a complete game. I have no room in my heart for nervousness, because I want him to pitch a complete game and go into the Dodgers series with those guys as rested as possible.
I think you only got one of those this year, right? From an Astros perspective, you have one complete game. Was that
Cesar Salazar?
Yeah, right.
He had one complete
immaculate inning.
He's got a 0.08 ERA, damn it. He's the best guy we've got.
No, who was it for the Astros earlier this year? It was like a very Greg Maddux-esque performance. Was it Fromber? Did Fromber throw that?
That's what I wanted to say, but I've got a history of being wrong on this.
I mean, yeah. It's the easy choice, right? If it wasn't Hunter Brown.
Oh, no, it was Fromber, because it was the 80. He only pitched
It was like 86 pitches or something,
pitches,
right?
Or whatever. Yeah, it was ridiculous. The game took 2 hours and 1 minute. So, it was 100% Fromber with the 83 pitch game.
Yeah, it was something like that. I remember thinking Greg Maddux the whole night. Me and PC did an H-Town post-game show that night, which had to be bumped up by like a full hour because it was just a fast game. I think it was like 1-0 or 2-0 ball game that evening. But he was third inning, 25 pitches, fourth inning, 38 pitches. It was just like, wow, this is pretty wild. And he was able to keep that up all night long. I thought he was going to do the same thing this past weekend at home against the Cubs. He was rolling through like the first 3-4 innings. I was like, man, he's got a shot to get you into the seventh or eighth inning, and then get a little laborious in the fifth and or the fourth and fifth innings. It was,
yeah.
But the Astros, how they progress forward with out Jeremy Peña and Yordan Alvarez, I don't think you should be worried about it at this stage. If anything, what has driven you crazy in years past pre-Joe Espada with Dusty Baker tinkering with the lineup, Joe Espada's done the same thing. It's just worked. And oddly enough, it's worked around a guy that has been healthy, at least from what we know, Christian Walker being the underperforming player that he has to this stage. Jose Altuve not really being the guy for long stretches that he's been prior to coming into this season. It's worked out really, really well.
So Yordan Alvarez and I can't be sitting here and like act like this 18-7 in one run games and everything is sustainable for too much longer without Jeremy Peña or Yordan Alvarez. You're eternally optimistic about this Astros team. It just honestly, tell me you're feeling about Yordan. Like what's the over under on number of games before he's back?
I'm going to say, including the rest of this first half number of games, I'll say a total of 30.
30 before he's back?
30 games.
Okay.
Yeah,
that's
a bit much. No, you know what? Because that's going to be a whole other month in the second half.
He's not even swinging a bat right now. And the last time he didn't even swing a bat, and then he's going to have to do the same thing in West Palm Beach,
all right,
and then potentially a minor league assignment by that time.
And
I think
would.
You're right. I think your gut was right.
Yeah, no, 30 games because I told you earlier, it's like, it's a broken hand, okay? It's a broken hand. Can you just let the break heal before he does, baseball activities like swinging bat, like 50% off of a tee? Like, I don't need to know that. I need to know that Yordan Alvarez in a month or so's time is going to come back healthy without any fracture, break in a hand or anything.
But that's the problem with the long layoff is that when you come back, you start having your, he's got to re-strengthen all those muscles.
I'll deal with it.
We don't know. He might. Hopefully, he didn't re-break it this time. It's just that his hand is sore.
Yeah, yeah. Who knows? They didn't define what the quote-unquote setback was. Luke Morrow actually in today with Reggie Atatula. My bad. I've been saying Chris Partee. My bad, Luke. Good to see. Do you have a very Luke Morrow-esque unique shirt on today? I cannot see you.
I don't know. I don't know what's become of this whole thing. I have a Pink Floyd shirt on today.
Yeah, you do.
Yeah, that's the answer is yes. Correct.
Yes. I knew I was going to get that. Like he knows what he's doing. He's just he's humble. Like the fashion game is strong with Luke Morrow. Reggie Atatula in as well. The guys from In the Loop, they'll have you from 10 to 2. What's happening, fellas?
Hey, man, not much. Enjoying another day of life in this great city of Houston. How are you guys feeling?
Doing great. There's nothing really to complain about. We've been talking about this all week, right? Rockets, check. Badass offseason. Astros continuing to crush everybody. Check. Well, what?
I mean, you guys are just talking about it. Here we go again with the Astros thing. I felt like such a sucker. I was like, all right, here we go.
It was predictable.
He's starting to work. Yes, it was. And yet and still, here I was like, look, I don't even need him to come back immediately. As long as he makes it back before the end of the season. And even now, I'm like, is that going to happen?
Yeah.
Are we going to get that? Like, that's the skepticism and the doubt that the Astros with injuries are able to give us because of the ways that they continue to handle things.
I feel like I put it out in the universe yesterday because Seth, we did a segment on, can Dana Brown ever, get to the Jeff Luhnow status? As an Astros GM, maybe with actual baseball moves, but in terms of evaluating the health of anybody, he gets a F-.
Yeah, at least the way they're handling it right now, that's going to be his greatest improvement is on just figuring out a way to somehow not having all these continual issues.
Yeah.
Let's see. We're flying blind today on the question of the day.
Yes.
So you got to pop it on us.
Well, to be fair, the question of the day changed a couple of times this morning, but it is stabilized here. In honor of Tony Parker, and I'll explain why here in a second, what 24-hour business would you want in your home? You could pick any business because apparently the streamer Kai Cenat was in Tony Parker's home and discovered that Tony Parker in his house has a 24/7 restaurant called Nando's. Are you familiar with Nando's or Nando's or however they utilize it or say it?
I think I've heard this before.
Yeah, it's popular in the UK. I know that there is at least one I've seen in the Galleria area here. But it's, kind of a spicy chicken spot. And I was like, that
when you're
is
saying in his house, you mean like in his condo or whatever, in the building that he lives in?
No, in his house, like his estate. He has, I mean, to be fair, we're using the term, has it in his house a little bit lightly, because it's like a backyard grill area, but it's Nando's themed, and they, like, I guess whoever the chef is there will make all of the main things on the Nando's menu. So
it's like,
I mean,
mother-in-law suite, but it doubles as a restaurant now.
Right? I mean, kind of. It's basically, I mean,
chef. It's quite the mother-in-law.
If you see the video, it basically looks like the Davante Adams Taco Bell commercial.
Yeah. That's what I
like,
was thinking.
It basically looks like that. So that's, I was wild. Like, I mean, we can go there, right? What business would you want in your house? Like, is it a restaurant? Because I feel like restaurant is going to be a lot of people's go-to.
Yeah, food's good. I would say, you know what? I need a Chinese food restaurant, like a 24/7 Chinese food restaurant in my house. Like, who doesn't crave Chinese food late at night?
Just Chinese. There's no actual business I want in my house, because I don't like having people around.
That's fair.
That's why I never wanted to be royalty. I don't like having servants around with their prying ears. I was at an Airbnb once that was in a building that had an elevator that went directly down into the supermarket. Like, you could, there was an elevator just for residents of the building. So you could take an elevator from, you could walk 10 steps outside of your condo door and then take an elevator down right into, like, dropping in baked goods. And that was awesome. That was 100%. I keep trying to convince my wife we need to live in a place like that. I would live in a studio apartment with a downstairs grocery store any day of the week over any other living situation.
Especially in that instance where it's 24/7. Like, you're cooking something, you forgot an ingredient, boom, yes. Go get it real quick.
Yeah,
or
yeah.
You wake up in the middle of the night and you're like, damn, I need some ibuprofen or something, I don't have it.
Yeah.
I want an entire apple pie.
That is also,
exactly,
yeah.
This is exactly why Brandy won't let us do it.
Cinnabon. I don't know why. You said apple pie, and I thought Cinnabon. Give me a Cinnabon in my house 24/7.
That's not good for your physique, though. Like, because the beauty of a Cinnabon is I only allow myself to have it in an airport, so that really limits the ability of damage that can be done. If you could just get it in any time, that's a real problem.
Yeah, good point. But if I had the ability to do that, I also don't think I would give a damn about what I look like or how I need.
Because you've already won. You won life.
I've won. I've got Cinnabon in my living room. Crosstalk sponsored by D&M Auto Leasing. Reggie Atatula and Luke Mora will have you from 10 until 2. Seth, Good Week Radio, he'll be on with you guys tomorrow as part of the... Reggie and Ron Radiothon. Good name choice, by the way. I like the order of operation there.